This is Chris Abalo's podcast experiment, and I am Chris Abalo. Welcome to the show. Cape 84. Can't believe we're already up to 84. I know I say that all the time, but man, these numbers just add up fast. Thank you all for continuing to support the show by clicking on the Amazon banner at chrisabalo.com. Just click on support the show. You'll find links to all our sponsors, including an Amazon banner. Please click through that and bookmark it as your go-to Amazon link. So when you make your purchases at Amazon, they'll give us a little commission on every purchase you make, and you won't pay a penny more for anything you buy, which is great. And a lot of people have said, I don't shop on Amazon that much. That's fine. When you do, they're still going to kick a little bit back to us. So I do appreciate everybody doing that. Thank you also for sending in donations via the PayPal button. Those are much appreciated. And with all the other sponsors as well, which we'll get to those a little bit later. Here I am for another solo show. Just going to be me today. No guests, which there's a lot to talk about. And frankly, I've been thinking about doing solo shows on a fairly regular basis. Cape 65 was just me at Skid Row Studios. Cape 75 was me solo again. And here I am, Cape 84. I was thinking about doing a solo show every time the Cape number ends in 5 from here on out. Now, granted, this week, this episode doesn't end in 5. And I probably would have done one next week because, number one, the intention for today's show was going to be an episode with Dan Hempel, my friend who has been on this show once before. It was about 2 years ago, Cape 21, 22, 23, possibly. I'm trying to remember. I should have just looked, or I should look now. But he's been on the show before, and he wanted to be on again, and we just couldn't make it work schedule-wise while I was home in New Jersey. And he's been on The Only Podcast That Matters a bunch of times, too, and has his own compilation episode. Check that out, theonlypodcast.com. But he was going to do the show with me. That was going to be this week's show, and then I was going to be on my own next week. But timeliness and the accumulation of things I want to talk about on my own seems like every 10 weeks would be pretty good. And people tend to enjoy the shows I do on my own, these little solo shows that I do, without a guest where I just talk to you directly about what's going on or share my opinions on various things. Stuff like that. So I figured, well, to make it a regular thing and something you know, okay, when Cape 95, 105, 115, when they come along, they're going to be solo shows. That's the intention. Not to say it wouldn't change depending on what's going on or if there was an occasion where I'd do a show, depending on the circumstances or whatever it is I'm doing the show about. But for right now, that's going to be a theme. I think that's going to be the theme. So every time the episode number ends in 5 from here on out, it'll probably be a solo show because I like doing them. You guys like listening to them. So I'm a fan. I'm down for doing it. Lots to talk about, of course. Spent a lovely 3 weeks in New Jersey. And something very novel happened. I flew out late night, took the red eye on December 21st, Monday night. Well, I guess it's still considered the red eye because by the time the plane actually left, oh, I timed it perfectly. I got to LAX at about 11:10, 11:15. Just had to check in my bag, and then I was going to be off, go through security, and then go to the gate, load in. Plane was supposed to leave at 11:54, so I thought, oh, this is great. By the time I get through security, they'll be boarding. I could get on the plane and go, and I was tired because I had a lot to do. The day you fly, you're always kind of figuring things out and trying to tie up any loose ends, and especially with being on the other side of the country for 3 weeks, I want to make sure everything that I needed to take care of with anything that wasn't going to be going with me or that wasn't digitally accessible via my phone or whatever, that I was able to take care of that. So it was a busy day leading up to it. So I even timed when I was going to be tired perfectly. And then I go to check in my bag and it says, your flight has been delayed and it was now leaving at 3:30 in the morning. Just imagine when you're tired having to stay up an extra 3.5 hours. And on top of that, basically everything except for one of the little newsstands that sells soda and chips and candy, everything else was closed. So I couldn't even eat. And I'm one of these people, it must be some kind of complex, where when I can't have food, I want it. Even though I'd eaten a sandwich, like a good 10-inch, you know, hoagie sub kind of sandwich, around 9 p.m., it had only been 3 hours, but I thought, I'm hungry. I need to eat something. and there was nothing substantial to eat. So I was pretty much stuck. I did grab some snacks, of course, and munch on them. And then slept the whole way through. Ended up landing a little after 11, Tuesday the 22nd. But there was a very strange anomaly. This has been, with all the flights I've taken since 2004, since I've been shuffling back and forth between California and New Jersey, this is the first time this has happened. I left for the airport when it was around 50 degrees and pouring rain. It started pouring. The sky literally opened up while I was on the 405 driving to LAX. And when I landed Monday morning, raining, about 50 degrees. So the weather was the same in Los Angeles when I left as it was in Newark, New Jersey when I arrived. Strange. That's never happened before. It was really weird because normally it's freezing cold. It's 12 degrees in New Jersey. And I'm leaving here and it's 2 years ago, I remember it was something like 81 degrees the day before I left. And I was working on a TV show and hanging out outside while the show was filming. And I sent a message to my friends back in Jersey saying, oh man, in 12 hours, I'm going to be in completely different weather conditions. Like the sun is shining, palm trees are just kind of flapping in the breeze, and it's going to be at least 50 degrees colder 12 hours from now where I am. So that was kind of weird. It was weird that this time it was actually the same. So yeah, I had that going for me and had a blast. Christmas was great. New Year's was great. And the time spent at home, especially after a year of not visiting home, I haven't been home since last Christmas. Man, it was a relief. It was a huge relief to see my parents, to see my friends, to see my extended family. It was great because you need that. You need to get away, even when you're living in a city and doing what you love to do. And you have even if things are exciting for you, you still do need to get away and to go visit home. And as my Uncle George wisely said, recalibrate the compass. And that's pretty much what I did. And it was nice to have an easy, kind of relaxed 3 weeks. I think last year I was home for 9 or 10 days. And it went by very quickly. And then before I knew it, I was back here in Southern California. So this time I was able to stretch out and relax and enjoy myself and do a couple episodes of the show. Had a blast doing the 2015 recap show with the guys from The Only Podcast That Matters. Because everyone's been asking, first of all, when I was going to have them on the show, one-on-one or what have you. Granted, Ryan Taggart called in to cape a couple episodes back when I was still at Skid Row Studios. And people have been asking, when are we going to do something as a group together, be it a show or a regular series or whatever it is as a group? When is The Only Podcast That Matters going to do something again? And it was always kind of like, well, we'll see what happens in the future. But we started talking a while ago because I like doing the recap of the news from the previous year, be it serious, legitimate news or kind of silly stories or what have you. I like doing that. And with them, was just doing it again was the best. And because it's been so long since we've done anything together, you could tell everybody was itching to do something together. A lot of enthusiasm in that episode. And that particular combination people like because they heard about The Only Podcast That Matters from listening to this show. So they went back and listened to the episodes and liked the dynamic. We still enjoy doing stuff together. So the occasion to get together and do something like this, especially within our wheelhouse, the type of thing we did on an annual basis together, was great. So it's essentially, Cape 82 is pretty much an episode of The Only Podcast That Matters. It's very much an extension of that show in that as much as I'm taking the lead, which I think I kind of have, at least in the last two recap shows we did, recapping 2012 and 2013, because I always had a list of stories that I wanted to talk about. And everybody else had them too. But this time I kind of curated a list of things I want to talk about them and didn't even get to everything, but we had a lot of fun. And I'm glad everybody enjoyed it. There was a great response to that. People enjoyed hearing us together. And have Veronica on last week was awesome. I've been wanting to have her on the show for the last 2 years. And every time I've gone home to New Jersey, I've tried to work it out or it just didn't fit in either of our schedules. We couldn't work it out. But now, especially with her being able to talk about her pregnancy and the birth of her daughter, was great to finally hear that. And women love Veronica. What can I say? Veronica always gets such a great response every time she was on The Only Podcast That Matters. And for people to be, in many ways, exposed to her for the first time in her kind of blunt, tell-it-like-it-is manner of speaking in the way she wasn't even being super precious about both her pregnancy and the birthing process was refreshing. People really enjoyed that. So, man, it was a lot of fun to do shows when I was back in New Jersey. I was very, very happy with that. One misnomer that drives me nuts, and it happened before I flew home. It's happened since I've come back. People say, oh, you're going back to Jersey. How was Jersey? Nobody in New Jersey has a speech impediment that makes them pronounce Jersey as Jersey. If anything, people from certain pockets of New York would say it as Jersey, but nobody in New Jersey says Jersey. Nobody has that weird of an accent. I'm going to say it's weird because if you don't recognize that there's an R in there, Jer is different than Joy. Well, that's weird. But nobody actually says that. So it's strange. It's one of those stereotypes that is completely untrue. Don't know where it came from, but everybody has to say, like, oh, did you have a good time in Jersey? Oh, you're flying home to Jersey for Christmas? Shut the fuck up. Please. Nobody says it. So I feel compelled to emphasize that nobody says that. But the week I got there, as I said, it was raining, and it rained the entire week. And I didn't completely escape the rain at all because El Nino swept through Los Angeles, or the residual rains came and hit for like 5 days. But I had a week of rain anyway, although it's more expected in the crazy climate of the East Coast as opposed to Southern California. I still had to deal with rain. It was nice for a little while. It was kind of refreshing because it rains so infrequently here, especially with how heavy it's been with the drought. But it was fun for a little while. It was tough to drive in. Did develop a little insecurity when it came to driving in the rain just because I haven't done it in so long. At least not on a regular basis. One funny thing, actually. As I said a couple weeks ago, I got a Honda CR-V. And I noticed that a lot of people in New Jersey have them too. It's kind of that way with everything. When you buy a new car or something that you notice it everywhere as soon as you have it. Suddenly it pops up everywhere. A car is the easiest example I can think of. But a lot of people in New Jersey have CRVs, but the difference is they have the all-wheel drive ones. Whereas out here, not so much. Not a lot of inconsistent weather out here, whereas with snow and ice and rain and everything back in the East Coast, makes sense to have an all-wheel drive vehicle. So that was one of the observations I made when I was home. Seems to be a pretty popular car, so yay, I guess. But anyway, it did enjoy the rain for a bit, and then, of course, it got old, and it wasn't even that cold. Of course, everybody has to say, oh, you brought the California with you, because Christmas Day was like 72 degrees, something ridiculous. And then it got down into the 30s a few days later, and it was kind of typical winter weather. And I think even the day I left, it was about 40 degrees, and then I came back to 65-degree weather here, which has been pretty nice. I've been able to acclimate very easily, but I'm definitely a West Coast wuss, as I've said before. My body has adapted to the weather we have out here, so I was really afraid it's going to be 22 degrees. You know, the high is going to be so low by comparison, and I'm going to be freezing. I'm not going to be able to handle it just because biologically I've adapted to warmer weather, but I made it. It wasn't so severe, although there were a few nights pretty cold. A few nights I think it got down to 17 degrees, but I made it and did okay. Just buried myself under blankets, and I survived. All right, got to talk about a lot of things that have happened in the past few weeks, because 2016 is off to a really rough start as far as, well, to be honest, the deaths of famous people. Obviously, people die every day who aren't famous, but in our celebrity-oriented culture, we pay attention when people go. But there are people who've made a genuine impression on the lives of those who mourn them when they're gone, as far as celebrities, as far as actors, musicians, and whatnot. Did touch on the only one that happened at the end of 2015 that I wanted to elaborate on, which was Lemmy Kilmister from Motorhead. I believe it's Kilmister. Maybe it's Kilmister. I don't know that I've gotten confirmation on how to pronounce his name. But because we had so many topics to cover on the show 2 weeks ago, we didn't go into individual detail as far as what Lemmy meant to each one of us, but I don't remember exactly how I became aware of Motorhead, but I'm sure it was hearing Ace of Spades on rock radio, like most people, because that's really the only song of theirs that got any airplay. As far as I knew, I couldn't really name any other Motorhead songs that in the 90s or 2000s would have gotten any airplay. Because Ace of Spades is their signature song. It's like if someone says Cheap Trick, well, odds are you're going to hear Surrender if you're listening to classic rock radio. And if you're listening to soft rock radio, you're going to hear The Flame. So the signature song is the one that ends up getting played most. So it was probably through Ace of Spades. But I remember getting back when I worked in Freehold Mall in Old Navy my senior year of high school. So 1999 and 2000. Remember going to The Wall, the music store. Which there were two of them for some reason, one at one end of the mall on the top floor, another at the other end of the mall, a larger one at the opposite end of the mall on the ground floor, and picking up one of those kind of budget compilation cassettes. It was official, but it was like $3.99, and especially in those days when it was just a matter of seeing, just absorbing everything. I wanted to hear all the music I possibly could. I remember picking up the cassette Motorhead Today, which was a compilation of their 90s output, which I think was 3 to 4 albums. Some of the most notable songs that were really good off of their albums from the label at the time was CMC International, and that's who put out this compilation, who were eventually sold off to, I think, Sanctuary Records. Bought up that catalog, but anyway, I digress. Of course, I picked up all the Aces, the compilation, which is all the greatest hits or the most notable songs. Of course, Ace of Spades, Killed by Death, Orgasmatron, the songs from the 70s and 80s that most people would know, or I don't know if you can call them hits per se, but some of the greatest Motorhead songs. And one of the first CD, well, I guess it would be the second CD I got of theirs was 1916, which was an early 90s album on, I think it was Epic Records. And the reason I got that was because it had the song Ramones on it. Lemmy, of course, was a huge fan of the Ramones. I was a big fan of the Ramones, still am. And just the fact that he wrote a song that was a minute and 25 seconds or whatever about the Ramones was awesome. So I had to buy that CD. So I got the 1916 album, which overall is great. And the song 1916 in particular, if you haven't heard that, it's a pretty, pretty stunning fiction, I believe it's fictional, unless it's dedicated to somebody in particular, but an account of a young man who goes off to fight in the war, and pretty heavy stuff, and interesting way to end the album, and shows a more tender side of Lemmy as he's not growling and, you know, his typical vocal style is actually singing rather sweetly as his character. But I picked that up, and shortly after picked up the March or Die album, which had the cover, which the main reason I got it is because it had a really cool cover of Cat Scratch Fever on it. Cat Scratch Fever, that sounds awesome. So I bought the March or Die CD, which also had a song he did with, it's called I Ain't No Nice Guy After All with Ozzy and Slash, which was a cool song too, kind of ballady, kind of a rocking ballad song. And also Lemmy wrote a bunch of the lyrics and a bunch of the songs, I guess, overall, on Ozzy's No More Tears album, which was my favorite album for a really, really long time, especially as a teenager. I love that album. I still do love it. It's in my top 10, but that was my number one favorite for a long time. And Lemmy wrote some great lyrics. Just a figure that was literally larger than life. I mean, he lived so many lifetimes in the 70 years he was alive, more so than the average person lives in 70 years. But I remember one particularly funny thing from my senior year of high school, which was the time I got the 1916 album, by the way, was I was kind of sitting at my desk in, I think it was Earth Science class. I think that was the name of it. And I was singing to myself or whatever I was doing just quietly before class. And the girl sitting to my left, whose name was Beth. Now, the beginning lyrics to the Motorhead song Ramones begins with, New York City, NYC, pretty mean when it wants to be. And the chorus is R-A-M-O-N-E-S, R-A-M-O-N-E-S, Ramones. And anyway, I'm kind of singing the song to myself. And this girl says, what are you doing? And I was like, oh, I'm singing this song. It's like, it's about the song about the Ramones. And she's like, is that what the New York City, NYC, R-A-M-O-N-E-S? I said, yeah. And she just said, do they spell? she didn't know what the Ramones were. She'd never heard of them. And she thought it was weird that lyrically, and it made me laugh because I thought, oh yeah, I guess if you have zero context for the fact that this is a song and who it's about, if you've never heard of the band or if you've never heard of Motorhead either, why they would even write the song. But she was so just stunned about, like, you know, New York City, NYC, RAMONES. And she even wrote that in my yearbook as like a little PS after the great to meet you, have a nice life, whatever the thing she wrote in my yearbook was, but wrote RAMONES-N-Y-C. Ramones, do they spell? That was pretty funny. I'm sorry to say the only time I saw Motorhead was in 2003 when I saw, get this, it was my first time seeing all three of these bands, because I saw July 2003, Iron Maiden at the PNC Bank Arts Center. This is shortly before their Dance of Death album came out, and they were kind of going out doing a greatest hits tour. And they did play the first single off the Dance of Death album, which hadn't come out yet, a song called Wildest Dreams. But anyway, sixth row, the PNC Bank Arts, their sixth row center. I think I paid like, I got a pair of tickets, and I took my friend with me. I think I paid like $165 a ticket or something like that. Sixth row center, way up close. Opening was Motorhead, and then Dio, and then Iron Maiden headlining. And the first time I saw any of those three bands, the only time I saw Motorhead, and the only time I saw Dio, which is kind of sad because it was so long ago, and I didn't, especially because Motorhead was playing up until, I think their last show was October, November, and as much as they'd come around, I never saw them again live, which is a shame. They were, and as far as memory serves, continue to be the loudest band I've ever seen in concert. Now, when you go to see a big show, particularly with a big stage, and you see the opening band, of course their gear is up front because the headliner stuff takes up the entire kind of back line of the stage. And obviously with Iron Maiden, there's a big stage setup. The amps were pretty close to us, and the volume was set really, really loud anyway. Mickey D's drumming his ass off, and then the guitar's loud, Lemmy's bass is loud and distorted. And it has that incredible kind of raspy, gravelly voice that he had. Man, I just remember being blown away at how fucking loud they were. And it was awesome. All the more reason I can't believe I never went and saw them again. But they had a good, I think, 40 minutes, which for Motorhead songs is still pretty good. You got to hear 10 or 12 songs. But yeah, I only saw them the one time. But what a great first experience to have, too, going to see them. And geez, I remember it is just Motorhead memories with Chris Abalo. I remember I got the, when I went home for Christmas in 2006 and went record shopping with the aforementioned Dan, picked up the most recent Motorhead album, Kiss of Death, in 2006, which actually had a re-recorded version of the Ramones song, sped up a bit more, a little heavier, a little louder, I guess was done in tribute because obviously three of the Ramones had passed since that time. So it was I think it was a hidden track on that album. But anyway, I listened to that album at the gym a lot. That was the first time I joined a gym and was bent on losing all the fat I'd accumulated living on my own for the first time in my early to mid-20s. And man, Motorhead's great workout music. So if you have any Motorhead or you want to get some, get a compilation or something, listen to Motorhead while you're at the gym, because it's upbeat enough or up-tempo enough to keep you moving, man. If you move with the pace of the music, then you'll get a hell of a workout in the span of a 35, 40-minute album. So, hey, that's my suggestion. So another cool Motorhead memory I had. Now, there have been a lot of people who say, especially when you don't know Motorhead, my parents don't know who Lemmy is, and when they tried to tell me about him, the fact that he passed, it's like, someone in a band, my parents always have the same kind of way of saying things to me, because they don't know who people are. I remember when Joe Strummer dies, like, some guy from some punk band just died, did you hear about this? Like, a really indelicate way of kind of putting it to you. They said, someone died from some Motorhead died? And I said, yeah, Lemmy, I heard about that. We heard about it tonight when we were at Ryan's house. But there have been a lot of questions by people who don't know, especially in these media interviews or these roundtables when they just have time to fill on a TV show, about, you know, how much of that was really an act. Now, in my humble opinion, I don't think Lemmy was an act, because think about it. The guy was born in 1945. So there really wasn't, and at the time he came up in the 70s particularly, there had yet to be that kind of drinking and whoring, hard partying, hard living character in rock music, almost caricature. Like, that hadn't existed really. And because of how Motorhead was certainly not a mainstream band by any sense, I don't know that Lemmy was cultivating an image on purpose. I believe Lemmy was a genuine article. and really was just being himself the entire time, which is great. What more could you ask for than to have somebody truly be themselves, for him to really be that guy instead of being an archetype? Those archetypes came along later when everybody thought they had to be a certain type of person to be taken seriously, or like, this is what rock and rollers do, or whatever the hell people thought of. But I don't think Lemmy was an act. I think he really, truly was that dude. He wasn't flashy. If you ever saw the Motorhead documentary, which you should seek out if you haven't seen it, 51% motherfucker, 49% son of a bitch. It's one or the other, but it's 51% one, 49% the other. It's a cool documentary. And he lives in a modest apartment, hangs out at the Rainbow, and, you know, as memorabilia from his band, he lived a really simple life and just a total road dog when it came to Motorhead always being on tour and putting out an album every 2 to 3 years. I mean, he never stopped. I mean, Christ, their most recent album came out in August, celebrating 40 years of Motorhead. So he just kept going, man. He really was that guy. He it wasn't an act. He wasn't putting on some kind of a stage persona. He was just that dude, which is great. And, you know, it happened so quickly, the fact that he found out 2 days before, I believe, that he had this form of cancer, that you can't help but wonder if he chose to go and chose to not fight and just took stock and said, you know what, I've lived a hell of a life. I don't want to spend my final days uncomfortable or out of it or in painful treatment or whatever, especially at the point when he'd been given 6 months to live or whatever the diagnosis was that he'd gotten. You can't help but wonder if he just said, okay, that's it, I'm done, and checked out on his own, just chose to go and chose not to fight. Because when you see how much people go through when they're fighting cancer, different forms of cancer, and just the quality of life that they have while undergoing treatment and while fighting an illness for what could be years, or you could go into remission and be clear and then have it come back. But I mean, at the point where he'd gone, it was, he basically had been given 6 months to live, and he wasn't that crazy about the 6 months that lie ahead. So he just decided to make himself comfortable. They brought his favorite game from the Rainbow over, and he just decided, you know what, I'm going out this way, which is pretty incredible. I mean, I could be totally wrong. It's just a theory, but it's a nice thought that the dude decided to go out when he decided to go out. He decided when the fight was over, or he decided to bow out rather than fight what could very well have been a losing battle, or certainly sounded like it was going to be a losing battle. And he just decided to leave when he did. Maybe it's just a nice thought, but it would be great if anybody who's suffering decides themselves when the battle's over instead of succumbing to something against their will. But just want to share my thoughts on Lemmy specifically, because just a lot of cool memories that I thought of. And shame I only saw the band once, and would have been cool to have met the guy. I mean, for as many times as I heard, oh, he's at the Rainbow, he's always hanging out at the Rainbow and living just over the hill from the Rainbow, I never took the trip to go over there and actually see if he was in the club hanging out. It would have been a cool dude to just shake hands with and say, hey man, thanks for the music, thanks for what you do, thanks for the work ethic and everything that you've put in. I appreciate what you've done. It's awesome. Especially just a couple days after his birthday. It sucks. It really, really sucks. And 70, no less. Which, he lived a lot in those 70 years, but it still seems far too young. And speaking of which, of course, not too long into the new year, the news came out about David Bowie. Now, David Bowie is not among my heroes. He's not among my favorite musicians. I have a tremendous amount of respect for David Bowie. I've gotten into his music peripherally. In fact, the biggest impact he's probably made is that he's in Labyrinth, which Jim Henson is one of my all-time biggest heroes. And the fact that he had such a huge role in a Jim Henson film and did the music, that's a really big deal. That's the probably the biggest impact he's had. But his music was always evolving, and because he wasn't a straight-up rock guy, and that's still what I listen to the most, just straightforward rock music. His sound evolved away from that as it came to be the 80s, and then further evolved in the 90s and into the 21st century. I never got into it as much, but I will say this. On his birthday, which was the day Black Star, his final album, came out, I was in the mall and was passing by FYE. Well, I should say I was walking into FYE, a music store in a mall. Imagine that. Those still exist in 2016. Few and far between, but they're there. And saw the vinyl of Black Star there and didn't know that David Bowie had a new album coming out. It just wasn't on my radar. But I saw his new album was there and I thought, oh, look at that. New album from David Bowie. Good for him. He's still doing it. That was literally my thought. And then 2 days later, he died. It's something that caught everybody off guard because nobody knew. Nobody knew he had cancer. Nobody knew how ill he was. He kept all that very, very quiet, which I can respect. I have a lot of respect for people who do that because think about how difficult, with everything you're going through, with treating, if you're living with the disease, treating the disease, and with any of your other day-to-day concerns while living with that disease, if it's public knowledge, do you want every time somebody sees you, and especially in a case like David Bowie, every time he makes an appearance on a TV show, does any kind of press, sees a fan on the streets of New York City or whatever, do you want people to ask you, are you okay? How are you? Every time somebody interacts with you, that's got to be grating after a while. Although I'm sure it comes from a good place. I'm sure the majority of people would want to know because they want to know you're doing well, and that's why they're asking. But overall, that would be tough. So I cannot blame him for keeping it quiet at all, especially because he obviously wanted to get this album out and wanted to see it through to completion and into its release. And same thing, that kind of will to live until the point when you say, okay, I'm at ease with going now, like my kind of wishful thinking for Lemmy. Same thing. He wanted to see this album get released. He wanted to be around for it. And then decided that the fight was over. I was the one who actually let my sister know that David Bowie died. Not intentionally. That was just the way it laid out. Because, wisely, my sister's not on any social media. And I am. So I heard about it. And while texting her, it came up. She, of course, read up on it and brought up a great point because David Bowie was only 69. And she said, hearing somebody dies at 69 is like hearing somebody died at 40 because it's just too young. And she's absolutely right. I remember being floored in 2008 after George Carlin died. He was 71. And it was weird even then to think, not that it was that long ago, but just to have the thought, who dies at 71? That's way too young. People are living into their, it's not unusual people live into their late 80s and into their 90s. Why? I mean, we know it was cancer, but you just think, how? How? That's too young. That's one of the things people can't wrap their heads around. It's just, why so young? Which seems to be a theme lately. But my earliest memory, aside from Labyrinth, David Bowie's music, my earliest memory, I'm sure Let's Dance was on the radio in the 80s. I'm sure I heard it. But the first time I was aware of David Bowie, that I knew who David Bowie was, in as much as he was a singer, this is really obscure, but here it is anyway, was the band he was in for a little while in the early 90s, Tin Machine. I believe he did two albums with them. When Macaulay Culkin hosted Saturday Night Live in 1990-whatever, Tin Machine with David Bowie was a musical guest, and I stayed up to watch that Saturday Night Live. Yeah, that was the first time I was aware of David Bowie as a musician and as a performer. And then I learned about everything else from there. And shortly after, in the late 90s, geez, I want to put it at maybe 97, 98, when he did the song I'm Afraid of Americans, which is just funny anyway as a title and as a song, even though I'm sure he had his reasons, unless it was just complete fiction. I've never really read up on it. But the video, which I remember seeing and thinking was fairly nuts, and it still is nuts, is like Trent Reznor firing guns at him or something. He's hiding, trying to keep cover and not getting mowed down by an enraged Trent Reznor. So that was kind of funny. But I always enjoyed David Bowie covers that I've heard. Def Leppard, one of my favorite bands, has done tons of them. And being such a fiend for collecting everything and buying every single and import and whatever to get all their songs, they had a bunch of B-sides that did Bowie covers. And I heard a lot through them, and the Joe Elliott, frontman for Def Leppard, and Phil Collin, the one guitar player, they had a project with the Spiders from Mars from the Ziggy Stardust era that they did, where they did Bowie covers called, it was a band called Cybernauts. And they did a live album. It was only released in Japan. And guess what? I own it. But that was a big exposure to David Bowie. And after getting that, from being a Def Leppard fiend, which is a common thread through whatever it is I've listened to, has ultimately turned me on to other stuff. That's when I got the Best of Bowie compilation, which came out in, I guess, 98, maybe 99. It was at the time the most recent Bowie Best of, just a single disc version that was maybe 20 tracks. And then it was, oh, Space Oddity. Okay, this song's kind of familiar. And the song Ziggy Stardust and these various other songs that I would later be like, oh, okay, now I know who David Bowie is. Including, of course, Let's Dance. And China Girl, man, I was going to dig it up. I know I have it somewhere, but I don't think anybody really cares to hear it. Maybe I'll post it if anyone's interested. But when I was in Musicians Institute, fast forward to 2007, I did the Classic Rock Live Performance Workshop. I used to do that regularly because, frankly, I knew a lot of the songs. But they're also the ones I wanted to learn how to play. And if you're going to have to play songs for grades, might as well be songs that you'd like to learn anyway. The 1 week, I did China Girl, which is another very recognizable David Bowie single. That came out really, really good. I remember enjoying that solo because it was just kind of an E minor thing, I believe, and just learning that, you know, that guitar riff, I guess you could call it, that opens up the song and just kind of continues throughout. And I remember finishing up with a solo and having a lot of fun doing it and getting some good feedback from a few people who were watching the performance, other guitar players who were going to get up and play. And a teacher, Tom Kolb, who was running it and grading the guitar players. I remember that was a lot of fun to play, and I didn't know the song very well up until the point when I had to learn it, and now it's a song that I know quite well, and that has stuck with me. Even several years later, I still know China Girl pretty well. Like I said, I have a lot of respect for him because he's a true artist, if there ever was one, in that he was always changing, and he was always moving on. It was never, like I said, not so much straight-up rock and roll music. Evolved into something different and did some more pop stuff. And, you know, even image-wise changed as far as from Ziggy Stardust to the Thin White Duke and all these other incarnations. Just ever-evolving, which is amazing. And I really do wish, it's kind of a shame that something we've lost is the kind of lure that there was to David Bowie in the 70s, where people wanted to believe he was from Mars. And you look at pictures of him from then, where his hair is crazy and he's pale and he's super skinny and people thought he was an alien and people wanted to believe he was from Mars. There was that kind of mystique that people bought into and wanted to voluntarily were like, this guy's an alien. It's a shame that that's lost. I mean, now in the internet age, everyone wants to disprove everything. Everyone wants to point out the holes in whatever movie or TV show or whatever the story is. Everybody wants to tell you what's wrong or what's missing or why it doesn't add up and what the inconsistencies are. So it's kind of a shame that's something we've lost. I mean, hell, in the 90s, there was the first time I became aware of the guitar player known as Buckethead, who, if you don't know, Google Buckethead, and you know what I'm talking about. But the dude wore, well, still does wear, a mask and a upside-down KFC bucket on his head. And you never knew who he was. And I remember the talk among the, you know, especially after I started playing guitar and buying all the magazines and hanging out with other musicians, and it was just always like, who's Buckethead really? Is it Paul Gilbert, or is it this guitar player, or whatever? And now everybody knows who Buckethead is, and he knows everybody knows who he is. But that mystery is gone. That's something that doesn't really exist now, especially with all the information being at our fingertips. So it's kind of a shame. But I do want to read something to you that my cousin Steve Morano wrote on Facebook, because I get this kind of feeling that he expresses, and it's one of the things, as I said, that I miss about something that we don't have in 2016, but what it was like to see somebody like David Bowie for the first time and be sucked in by it, I'm sure that must have been amazing, and I really loved what he had to write, so I'm going to read/perform the status he threw up on Facebook with his permission, and as a musician himself who's counsel and feedback I sought, along with advice. We kind of recommended music to each other and still do. But I want to read to you what he wrote about David Bowie, because I thought this was an excellent way to sum up. And while I can't apply this to David Bowie personally, I have my own group of musicians and performers who I can apply this level of attraction to. But anyway, let me read you what Steve wrote about David Bowie. Why this day feels so bad. Kind of hard to find words. And it feels a bit stupid that someone you don't know, never met, has no clue who you are, can have such an effect on your life and emotions, but it is what it is. Those of you who've endured countless Bowie posts from me, well, here's why. I was lucky to grow up in a great time, with a great family and friends, great town. So Steve, why are you so screwed up? Music was very present in our home, whether it was my parents blaring their operas on Sundays, or their big band music, or what was on the radio, AM at the time, you know, the Beatles, the Stones, British Invasion, or what my siblings were listening to. We were all very into music. We were all addicted, I'd say. Whatever was current, whatever was past, as long as it was rock and roll related. I used to dig into my oldest brother's records frequently. I was a kid. I had no idea what I was listening to, but wanted to hear it. Cream, Creedence, Rare Earth, Jay Giles, Savoy Brown, the list goes on. But we were also heavy into the oldies and doo-wop tunes. I guess it was 1974, sophomore year in high school. Now you're listening to FM radio, hanging out with guys and girls, going to parties, getting into, for better or worse, what everyone was listening to. At the time, Bad Company made their appearance. There was Zeppelin. Elton John was huge. BTO was on a roll. Tons of other stuff I'd yet to discover. There was no MTV yet, so exposure to these acts was minimal. Back east, we had a few late-night music shows. Midnight Special, Don Kirshner's Rock Concert, and In Concert. In Concert used to simulcast over New York rock and roll station, WPLJ. So, one Friday night I'm up, going to check out In Concert. The artist on is David Bowie. Heard the name, but know nothing about him. But I'll check it out. I turn this program on, and... wait, what? There's this guy there. Wait, is that a guy? Well, his name is David. Must be a guy. He's got carrot-colored hair. And he's wearing... wait, what the hell is he wearing? What is this? And his guitar player? Equally freaky. Just wailing away on guitar. This stuff's from another planet. What the fuck? I was glued to the TV. I couldn't even blink. Mind just blown. Well, it was late night. Eventually I get the, "Steven, go to bed!" from Mom. Shit. The TV was in the basement. We slept on the second floor. So I go up to the bedroom where my brother Emil already is. I ask if I could turn on WPLJ to listen. Luckily, Emil was an enterprising young man who worked and saved and bought a stereo. I'm trying to tell him about this guy slash alien I was watching. I don't think I was making much sense, like now. He let me put on WPLJ, and I tried to listen, but that didn't last too long. I had to see it. Snuck back downstairs to the basement to watch. I couldn't not watch. It was all over at that point. That was the point in life where I said, man, I gotta do that. I gotta play guitar. It took a couple of years to get started, but eventually did using my sister's guitar, thanks Joe, and a Bowie songbook, Diamond Dogs, the books where they have the little chord formations up top. There was no turning back. Me and my oldest, dearest buddy, Eric Nielsen, dove in deep. Bowie was the shit. No one compared at that time. Back at that time, Bowie was not a household name by any means. He had a big following, a big cult, really, but it wasn't like it was today. There were plenty for whom he was too freaky, too weird, etc. So when you met someone who was into Bowie, cool. You'd met a kindred spirit. Someone who was in on it, who got it. Being a Bowie fan was a place where you belonged, felt welcome. You'd meet a Bowie fan and you were friends, which is pretty much how I met my good friend Mike, T-Slug Diamant. We had a few classes together, and then one day the subject came up, oh, you're a Bowie fan? And so it went. Over the years, Bowie has changed his skin so many times. I can honestly say I didn't always like the new skin, didn't always like the latest music trend he was into, but I did appreciate that he had the balls to change that skin, to delve into that trend. And let me say this, Bowie rarely followed a trend. He set them, usually. Influenced millions, myself included. Made us laugh, made us cry. Composed the soundtrack for a good part of my life and our lives. A truly original, fearless genius of an artist, the like of which has very few peers. As I said earlier, he was one of many kinds. Thanks, Mr. Bowie, for all of it. Life wouldn't have been the same. To close, I saw a quote today that said something like, "The world existed for 4 million years, and you managed to exist at the same time as David Bowie." Interesting way to look at things. I, for one, am thankful. So there you have it. Certainly the best tribute I've read about David Bowie. However, I'm obviously slightly biased. But seriously, I did really enjoy that. And I get what it means to have that kind of attachment to somebody. And moving on to somebody who everybody has an attachment to in one form or another, Alan Rickman. Just days later, we get the news about Alan Rickman having died also of cancer. also kept quiet, if I understand correctly, which, you know, same amount of credit to him. He kept on working. There's something I read. There was a post that was written on Nerdist.com, which is something I hadn't really thought about. And it was the writer had basically said how important Alan Rickman was to Christmas for them. I watch Die Hard every year. I watch Love Actually every year. So Alan Rickman is an annual part of Christmas for me, too. And, of course, Harry Potter. And there are some, I believe most of the Harry Potter movies have a Christmas holiday element to them. So that also means something to people at Christmas, is that, oh, it's Harry Potter and Alan Rickman's in Harry Potter. So it's crazy. And he's also one of those actors who has, depending when you were born, he does mean something different to you. If you're a child of the 80s or grew up in the 80s in some capacity, he was Hans Gruber. He was the badass villain and one of the most beloved villains from one of the most beloved action movies of all time. If you're a child of the 90s, Dr. Lazarus in Galaxy Quest or Metatron in Dogma, or of course in 2000s, or if you're of any age and are into it, he's Severus Snape in Harry Potter. So it's kind of funny, and in the way that people had such an outpouring of emotion and were equally surprised when Robin Williams died, Alan Rickman's the same in that he meant something different to everybody. Depending who you ask, they have a character who they think of when they hear Alan Rickman. They're like, oh, he was Snape, or oh, he was Hans Gruber, or whatever. In the same way, depending on your age, when you thought of Robin Williams, it was he was Mork or Popeye, or oh, he was great in Good Morning Vietnam, or eventually the Genie, or Mrs. Doubtfire, or, you know, and the list goes on and on. So everybody had a point of reference for Alan Rickman as well. And I definitely, when it comes to actors, haven't seen the outpouring of emotion for anyone's death since Robin Williams. Alan Rickman's is the only one I can think of that's on par with Robin's, in that everybody has something to say about him. One of the great actors, and again, one of those guys who didn't get, nobody knew until, well, I don't want to say later in life, that's not fair, but he was already well established at the point where he made his film debut in Die Hard. And what a debut. I mean, come on, Hans Gruber. In a lot of ways, and in part because of the Die Hard structure where it became Die Hard on a plane or Die Hard in a on a boat or whatever the hell, Die Hard in the White House, whatever the variations were. It was very much who Hans Gruber was as a villain, whereas a villain you didn't completely hate. That became something people wanted in movies. And I really think, I don't know if I can name any where people kind of enjoyed the villain as much as Hans Gruber until Heath Ledger's Joker. That's the only other one that really springs to mind where it's a villain that people like. Okay, Loki is another one, but he came after Heath Ledger's Joker. But Loki, of course, in the Thor movies and the Avengers, where it's a villain people like. And a lot of wonderful things written about Alan Rickman as well, from fans and, of course, by the many actors and directors he worked with over the years. And one of those dudes you just know was well-liked by everybody. It's funny how people always ask me, too, with being out here, they just want to know who the assholes are in show business. You know, who's this person that much of an asshole? Is this one a prima donna? You know, whatever the hell. You can tell the good people when you see them. You know, there may be a few exceptions, but overall, you know who the good people are. And especially because they keep working. And Alan Rickman was always working and has been in tons of movies. And everybody has a point of reference for him. And it's kind of cool in that he will forever be remembered. Once again, like Robin Williams, he will be remembered for a variety of roles, not just one signature character. He has a few of them, which is awesome. Once again, 69, way too young. Way, way too young. And, you know, today, as I'm recording this, and some people are used to the episodes coming out first thing Monday morning, and this one I'm recording on Monday night because I knew I was doing a solo show and I wanted everything to be fresh. And lo and behold, I have a little more to talk about in that I was at the movies this afternoon, went and saw The Big Short, which was excellent. I absolutely recommend everybody see that movie. It was incredible. Really thoroughly enjoyed that movie, as well as Gotten Angry. And it's also, quick sidebar, the first movie I've seen where the audience was actually reacting to what was going on screen. People were clapping when certain things were said. People were groaning. People were going, mm-hmm. because, as of course, it's based on a true story, based on actual events, you know, everything that led up to the economic collapse in 2008. So it was interesting to hear how much of a reaction the audience was having while watching the movie, because everybody knows what was going on. Everyone in there was of the age to be aware of what happened when things started to take a nosedive. And I'm sure plenty of them have mortgages and were able to relate to a degree, and retirement funds, etc. But anyway, got out of the movie this afternoon and had a text waiting from my friend Ryan Taggart saying, yet another one, Glenn Frey died today. Now, we knew Glenn Frey was sick because of it had been out there that he had been ill recently, and it seems like this was the result of an accumulation of illnesses, but 67. It's so insanely, like, wow. Everybody who's died recently have all been young. I mean, even I don't have any really references to go back to Natalie Cole, who was also at the end of last year, but, you know, she was 65, and it's just, we can't wrap our heads around the fact that these people are just going way before their time. And again, they're famous people. They're part of a smaller group, whereas people die, sadly, from cancer and from various ailments or accidents or what have you every day. People who we don't know, people who are anonymous to the majority of us. Just to wrap your head around the fact that these people are gone. It's sad to think that now we are in, as much as we were alive at the same time as these legends, we're also at the point when these legends are going to die. I mean, biologically, yeah, I'm going to have to deal with, if things go naturally, then yeah, I'm going to have to mourn the death of Eric Clapton and Sammy Hagar and Bruce Dickinson and tons of people who I'm fans of. And, you know, Tom Hanks. It's crazy to even say it, to verbalize it. But the truth is, obviously, everyone's going to die. All this is going to be over someday, at least as we know it. But it's crazy to think, you know, like I said, people are living into their 80s and 90s. Why are these people going so young? Granted, last year, B.B. King died, and he was a legend and a pioneer, and it was a huge loss. But it wasn't as sad because he was 89. He was closer to 90 than 89. So he lived a long, full life. And when you hear about people dying at 67, 69, 70, you think, man, another 20 years. Think of what they could have given us. You know, at least when it comes to artists, when it comes to musicians and actors, when you think everything they could have done. It's actually one of the things that is resonating with me more so because of the age range of everybody, including Natalie Cole. We're going 65 to 70. That's the age range my mother's in. My mother's 69 right now, and my father's 74. So I'm processing it from the perspective of people who are my parents' age are dying. And once again, if things go in the evolutionary way they should, of course, I should be alive when my parents die. They should die before me. But it's not something I want to think about. It sure as hell isn't something I want to think about when I feel like they have so much life left and that they could be around for another 20 and 30 years. And my parents are healthy. They have clean bills of health. They don't have any disease that they're aware of. In fact, when I was home, my father went to a few doctors. Well, he went to see his regular doctor and was recommended to go see a cardiologist, just because at 74, most people have already started seeing a cardiologist. So because of age, it was practical for him to start seeing one just to see where he's at. Makes total sense. So we went to a cardiologist for the first time. So he's going to be going through a litany of tests over the next couple of weeks, because they're tests that haven't been performed on him because he's been healthy. But it's something that's just tough to wrap your head around. Again, for me personally, just because of, aside from what these people meant to me, the fact that their age is too young, and I look at my parents and think about how much life they have left in them, and sad. I don't know. It's just crazy sad that all this is happening. And unfortunately, you know, once upon a time, maybe, you know, when Cary Grant died, I'm sure there was a bit on Entertainment Tonight or maybe the evening news about him, or Nat King Cole or Hank Williams, you know, when they died in their day, it wasn't made to be as big of a deal. And maybe they weren't as known or as appreciated or didn't have the body of work or whatever. Whereas now I just feel like there's a much larger impact when somebody famous dies, especially when it's too young. But the Eagles, geez, I've known about them for ages. I mean, when they reunited for Hell Freezes Over, I was 12 or 13. So Hotel California was getting played everywhere. And I love that acoustic rendition they did on that live album. with that nice guitar and that acoustic intro that I believe it was Joe Walsh who did that. But got into the Eagles, never huge into them, but particularly From Hotel California forward and the more rocking songs, you know, not the as a countrified stuff of the early days, although they certainly have a bunch of great songs. But actually, one of my favorite tracks, which I'm sure you can find on YouTube or through whatever streaming service you use, I imagine it's on there, is a collection of outtakes, which I'm a fan of, which is called Random Victims. It's part two or part three. It's just a bunch of outtakes from over the years, which for as much as you think of the Eagles and the songs didn't necessarily have a pinch of humor to them, although maybe just a pinch. But to hear these outtakes of them in the studio and hear them kind of screwing around is really, really funny. So that's one of the things I'll listen to sometimes just because there isn't any musical value in it except for hearing them tweak the lyrics as they're going through these takes, these kind of outtakes of them singing songs. It's pretty funny. If you haven't already seen it, watch the History of the Eagles. It's on Netflix right now. And it's about 4 hours because it's very in detail. And they talk to all the guys, which is great. Because that's also something rare. Usually when they get together when bands get together for a documentary, usually someone's left out, someone has sour grapes or whatever. But the Eagles, thankfully, they talk to all the guys, which is great, and it's incredibly thorough, and it's a great story. Also about a bygone era, by the way, because music industry as we know it, totally different than it used to be. There you go, Glenn Frey, another one gone way too soon. It's such a strange note. I mean, we're not even 3 weeks into the new year, and we're losing legends. It's really, really strange to think about. But whether it's 2016 or 2036, it's something that if you're of a certain age, if you're 34 like myself or younger or a few years older, then it's likely inevitable that you'll have to deal with the death of legends. But like the quote said, at least we were around when these people were alive. And that's the way it goes, generation after generation. Life just keeps moving along. It's a continuous process. But man, what a strange way to start out the new year, and sad. And obviously I had a lot of thoughts about these people that I just wanted to share. Let's hope things get better from here. Let me put myself in a better mood. I'm going to talk to you about my friends at audible.com. Audible has over 180,000 downloadable audiobook titles, one which I own that I have yet to listen to, but is now rocketed to the top of my must-listen-to list, is Heaven and Hell, My Life in the Eagles, written by Don Felder, former member of the Eagles. That was 1974 to 2001. Now I want to hear about it because Glenn Frey doesn't have an autobiography, but I certainly want to hear about the Eagles. There are titles about David Bowie. And guess what? If you're a fan of and miss Alan Rickman, as we all do, he did audiobooks. It's a 15-hour reading of The Return of the Native, narrated entirely by Alan Rickman. Guess what? 15 hours of Alan Rickman's sultry voice can be yours for free. All you need to do is go to audibletrial.com/cape and sign up for a free 30-day trial, and you get a free audiobook download. And you can listen on your iPad, your iPhone, Android phone, your Kindle, your PC, your Mac, whatever. Get the Audible app. I use it. I have it on my phone, and that's how I listen to audiobooks. I've been an Audible member for over 5 years, and I love it. And like I've said before, listen to an audiobook when you're doing mundane stuff like taking the dog for a walk or doing the dishes or cleaning the bathroom or vacuuming or whatever the hell, because you're not going to remember the activity, but you're going to remember enjoying that book Alan Rickman was reading intimately in your headphones. Think about how cool that is. Anyway, audibletrial.com/cape. Get a free audiobook and start a free 30-day trial and check out everything they have to offer. Audible is awesome. One final note about all this. I'm sure now Hot Topic and Urban Outfitters will be flushed with Motorhead, Lemmy, and Bowie merchandise. And you know what? I'm okay with it because while a handful of people will be wearing them just to be fashionable and show like, yeah, man, I was always into David Bowie or I was always into Motorhead or whatever the hell. That's my that's my person who's riding a trend voice. I hope that there will be many who will pick up an instrument and learn how to play Motorhead songs, David Bowie songs, whatever, and make their own music, because these people left behind a legacy. And that's why they're mourned by so many. They left something behind. Isn't that what everybody wants? We all want something that's going to outlive us. Something that's going to carry on when we're no longer here. And that's what these men have. So there we go. Those are my thoughts on everybody who has unfortunately passed away. Okay, speaking of Urban Outfitters, I noticed if you follow me actually on Instagram, at Chris Sells Out, that's my Instagram handle, and at Chris Abalo on Twitter, shameless plugging at the end of all this, all the morning, I posted a photo a couple weeks ago about cassettes being back in production because Nirvana's album Bleach, back on cassette, brand new, newly available, and NWA's landmark Straight Outta Compton album, also on cassette. I saw just right after the holidays a bunch of Blink-182 albums newly released on cassette. Lana Del Rey's last album came on cassette last year around the time it came out, and freshly released, I believe, in January of 2016, just came out, Justin Bieber's latest album. And it's something I was actually going to talk to Dan about, but since I don't want to have this conversation 3 months from now, I'm just going to have it with you directly, the one-sided conversation. I think the reason cassettes have novelty to them is the same reason vinyl sales are on the incline. Because kids for the last 10, 12 years, they've grown up with iTunes and streaming, and, you know, be it Pandora or whatever means they use to listen to and discover new music. Everything's been digital. So now the pendulum's kind of swinging in the other direction. I guess the cultural pendulum is swinging the other direction, and physical formats have some kind of novelty. And when Dan and I got together, the one kind of half day we spent together, we did one of the things that we love to do the most, which we talked about when he was on CAPE 2 years ago, which was go to Vintage Vinyl, a record store in Ford's, New Jersey. And while we were browsing around, because I take forever, although he's guilty of being in there for a long time, but I always have 12 CDs on my arm, and then I have to leave with a few less than that. But there were two kids, I'm going to say they're 20 tops. Of course, I'm at the age where I have no gauge for anyone who's younger than me, so they could have been 25, but I'm going to put them at like 19, 20. And they each had an arm full of records, and I assume there were a couple, maybe they were brother and sister, but you know, it was a boy and a girl. And the girl actually went up to the counter and asked about specially ordering the vinyl version of Taylor Swift's latest album. And I thought, wow, how cool is it that they're going out, they're going to a little independent record store. This isn't a store in the mall. And this isn't Urban Outfitters or Barnes & Noble or stores which also have a vinyl section. I mean, hey, Whole Foods has a vinyl section now, or most of them sell vinyl. It's not like that. They're actually going to a record store and looking for these records, which is pretty fascinating to me. And actually, for fear of being the creepy guy who may have asked, or some random stranger who they don't know, maybe not creepy, but the guy who they didn't know, coming up to them and asking them why, I really wanted to ask them, why is it you guys came here? Why is it you're looking for records? What is it that draws you to it? Is it because it's physical? Why is it you're coming to a record store instead of going to some chain to buy records? I really wanted to know. But thinking on it, I believe that's got to be what it is. Because now there's a fascination with stuff that's physical. The same reason Polaroid cameras and all these Instamatic cameras are now back. They're being manufactured again. That's pretty funny because everybody can take photos on everything in their pocket. Everybody's had the ability to take photos on their phone, but now there's a physical result of taking photos that lends something to it. Now it's, oh, cool. I can take a photo and then something pops out and then I have this photo that I can hold in my hand. So tactile product is now becoming cool again, which I kind of like. I think that's very, very cool. Wish I had asked them, but again, didn't want to seem weird. But yeah, there you go. The kids are buying vinyl and kids are apparently buying cassettes. And now companies are making not just the Walkman style cassette player with headphones, but actual like cassette players, like the things I had when I was a kid before I got a boombox. You know, a little cassette player with a speaker that's like a flat kind of, not flat, but a rectangle shape cassette player, top loading cassette player. I'll bet. Out of everybody, you know who's probably losing their minds with excitement over all this? Duracell and Energizer. Because considering everything from our smartphones to iPods and tablets and everything else, they've all had rechargeable batteries. I'm sure people who are in the battery business are throwing tremendous parties and saying, yeah, finally we get to sell some C batteries to kids who want a little cassette player, or double A's to kids who buy a portable cassette player. It's pretty funny. I'm sure they're having tremendous parties at their headquarters saying, yeah, we're back in business. People are buying batteries again. So that's my theory as far as why products are now selling, why physical media is selling again, because I think there's a novelty to it. If you're of a certain age, hey, you've grown up with stuff being digital. But now, hey, I can have a physical photo. I can have a physical album. This is great. Kind of funny. Even in the same way vinyl is coming back. I mean, soundtracks from movies in the 90s that never even had a vinyl release are getting released on vinyl, and people are into it. I don't understand specifically the rise in vinyl sales, even though it's the fastest growing physical format. Like, the numbers are up. I forget what the data was. It's one of the things I wanted to touch on actually 2 weeks ago when we did the 2015 recap. But it was hundreds of percentages that vinyl sales were up over the previous year. Vinyl sales were up by a lot in 2015 compared to 2014, in part because my theory, once again, is that record companies have gotten wise and included download codes. So you can download a digital version of the album, so you're not just buying a physical version, then having to buy a version you can carry around on your mobile device or stream from the cloud. But now you're actually getting multiple formats for your purchase, so you're actually getting more for your money. Aside from that, it's the least convenient format. I mean, think about it. CDs, you could always play in your car. Cassettes before that, you could play in your car. 8-tracks before that, you could play in your car. You can't play a vinyl record in your car. That's why I think it's weird that that's the one that has the most appeal right now, is vinyl records. And it's not like DJs are spinning records anymore. They all have laptops and they're just pushing buttons. Like, I don't know, they look like assholes to me, but whatever. I'm just surprised by vinyl specifically, because, and another thing I would have asked these kids, like, why vinyl as opposed to anything else? We're in a store that has loads of CDs. I mean, maybe 25% of the store was vinyl, and the other 75% is all CDs. Why is it you guys are going for the records as opposed to their CD counterparts for these albums? Weird. But physical stuff's on the rise again, so hey, good news. What can I say? All right, one more complaint. Oh, now Chris is going to spring to life when he's talking about music. Well, I'm not talking about sad stuff right now. It's more questions. But one complaint. I've said before, the self-checkout is annoying. Talked about it many times. I don't understand. And the fact that it's even more frequent, as far as I could tell, in New Jersey, where I can't count the number of times someone who has a cart full of shit that they're buying at the store, particularly the grocery store, because it's different when you go to like a Target or a Walmart. You may be getting a couple of things, not necessarily filling up a cart, but at the grocery store, people buy food by the cart. So it seemed to be a lot more of those at self-checkouts, at least in my experience. Another one of those things I don't understand, because instead of going through the line with a cashier who does this all day long, who is most likely faster than you, you're going to go do it yourself. I guess the logic is like, I'm not waiting on some cashier. I'm going to wait on myself and go as fast or slowly as I have the ability to. But it's even more bizarre in a grocery store, because there are a lot of variables where you can't just straightforward ring things up that have a barcode. There's produce or self-serve pastry, where there's a different process. And somehow, it's pretty easy to me, but I've also worked in retail for a long time, particularly managing cashiers and as a cashier for the majority of that time, or at least always running a register during my entire retail experience. But I can see when you're buying bagels that you could hit the search for item by name button and type in BAG for bagels. Tap on the picture of bagels, type in how many when they ask you the quantity, and then put them on the scale, which is a scanner because they're one and the same, and then it verifies it that, yep, this is the weight of 4 bagels, and then the register will tell you, all right, put it over there with the rest of the shit you need to bag up and scan your next item, which they never say that. The woman who's digitized female voice is walking you through never says that, but oh, somebody hire me to do the casual and semi-aggressive self-checkout voice. All right, put it over there with the rest of your shit. Scan your next item. Come on, that'd be great. Wouldn't you want to shop in that store? I would, even if it wasn't my voice. That's exactly what I want to hear. But the self-checkout thing, the fact that people do it, especially when they have a ton of stuff, and it's definitely going to take longer with them doing it on their own, I don't understand. Now, the cousin to self-checkout, as I've learned, the self-serve ATM. Now, ATMs are obviously self-service, but now ATMs offer more services because you can deposit checks and you can deposit cash. And I went through a bank to use the ATM to make a cash deposit instead of going inside, which was my mistake. Now, I think I'm pretty efficient because I understand how to work an ATM. I've used an ATM my entire adult life, so it's not new to me, back when they were just for taking out cash. Imagine that. But with these other services, they seem pretty straightforward, and I can navigate my way through a touchscreen with ease. However, I pulled in, of course, there's a woman at the self-serve ATM, and she's going to, I realize, by the way, the term self-serve ATM is redundant, but just go with it. Now, she's too far away to be able to reach the ATM from her driver's seat, so what she has to do is get out, but because she's also, she can't open her door all the way, her door is open just a bit, and she actually had to open the window and step out of the car, and now, to operate the ATM, to do deposit, withdrawal, whatever the hell she's doing, she's standing in the space between the 42 degrees that her door is cracked, or whatever, it's probably less than that, and the car itself, the body of the car, while she's making her transaction. And I couldn't help but think while looking at her, is this really faster than going inside and having a teller take care of you? Again, the joke's on me, because this obviously took longer for me to wait in line behind this broad than actually go in and have a teller take care of my cash deposit. So there you go. But I've decided that upon seeing that and a handful of other experiences, I think ATMs, with all the services they provide now, the self-service that you can do for your account management at the ATM, I realize that those are the cousin of the self-serve checkout. All right, one final note. I finally saw Star Wars. Went by myself because it was one of those nights where I was home and my father was watching the playoffs, my mother was watching whatever shows she was watching in another room, and thought, well, let me just go to the movies and see Star Wars by myself, because I'd managed to avoid spoilers. I didn't know anything that was going to go on in the movie, and I figured, okay, the movie's been out for 2 weeks. This probably isn't going to last much longer. The movie's going to be spoiled for me. I did want to see it in the theater, because I've never seen a Star Wars movie in the theater. So I said, okay, fine. I'm going to go, and I'm going to have fun seeing this movie by myself. Plus, my parents live up the street from a movie theater, literally 2 miles from a movie theater. And I saw a show that was, I believe, at 9:20 at night, and it was only $10, which was incredible to me, because I can't go see a movie here in the Los Angeles area after 12 noon and pay only $10 to be able to see an evening show, a 2D show. I didn't want to see the movie in 3D, but still, to see a movie for $10 at night after dark was crazy. So I had to go see it, and the movie was good. Not great, but good. I don't understand the crying, you know, the middle-aged men who are just getting all upset and worked up and seeing all this. But, it was good. I enjoyed it. I thought the humor was well played. I enjoyed that more than I enjoyed certainly any of the action of throwbacks. There's still some things I find goofy, like the weird stormtrooper kind of jog that they do, and the fact that the stormtrooper outfits look like cheap plastic PVC pipe. Like, I just can't take that stuff seriously. I just think of it as being so goofy. But whatever, I enjoyed it. I'm glad the fans like it. I really do. I've said, as much as I've picked on Star Wars in the last couple of months, I'm glad people like it. I'm glad it's made a ton of money. I'm glad that Lucasfilm did sort of the fan servicing and getting them back on board for being into new Star Wars movies, because time has shown that people are not fans of the prequels. So they really had to win the audience over with this new movie. And they did. And look, I'm going to go see the next Star Wars movie when it comes out, the anthology movie, Rogue One. And I'm going to go see Episode 8 when it comes out. So I'm in. I'm not complaining about it. But by comparison, I'm more into the aforementioned Harry Potter or the Marvel movies or these other things. I'm not as invested in Star Wars as I am other franchises. And that's okay, because now there are options. So, you know, kids growing up now are going to have all these different things to choose from. Like, well, there are 7 Star Wars movies. I mean, if you're I'm not going to say an infant, but if you're a young child right now, you have a bunch of Star Wars movies. You have a bunch of Marvel movies. You have a really cool Batman trilogy. Well, 2/3 of it's really cool. But anyway, there are a lot of movies for you to choose from. And 3 really good Indiana Jones movies. Whereas we kind of just had Indiana Jones and Star Wars when I was growing up, and Back to the Future, of course, the Back to the Future trilogy, which will forever remain a trilogy, and the trilogy, by the way. But I enjoyed Star Wars. I finally saw it, so everybody can back off me for not seeing it. Now, the one thing I want to know, and the same can be said for Marvel, are those who were considered before nerds pissed that Star Wars is as big as it is? Or are they happy? Because there are a lot of things, you know, the same thing can be applied to music. Like when a band becomes too big, it's just like, oh, a bunch of sellouts or whatever. And people get kind of bitchy, whereas they want to keep it in their pocket for a little while. And they don't want everybody to know about it because they want it to be their thing and their secret. And I'm into this and you don't even know about it. Star Wars is one of the biggest franchises in history, especially now with this movie that's going to make at least $2 billion and will continue printing money in perpetuity. Can nerds really claim Star Wars anymore in the same way you can claim Marvel? I mean, Marvel's based on a different property. The Star Wars movies were films first, and then all these other forms of media sprang out of that, the video games and the novels and comics and all these other properties that exist based on the Star Wars movies to begin with. I realize Marvel came from comic books. I really don't think nerds can claim Star Wars. You can't say, like, I'm a nerd, I love Star Wars anymore, because everybody loves Star Wars. Star Wars is officially as mainstream as it gets. Look, when everyone from Walmart to Nordstrom's is selling Star Wars shirts, it's as mainstream as it gets. It's no longer a nerd thing. You can no longer say you're such a nerd or you're a geek or a sweaty or whatever it is you want to call yourself because you like Star Wars, because everybody likes Star Wars. And now everybody has seen this new movie. Anyone who has any remote interest has seen the movie. It's, as of now, actually been out for a month. So anyone who is really into Star Wars or enjoys Star Wars or is mildly curious has seen the movie already. So I really don't think nerds can claim Star Wars anymore. But that's just my opinion. I wonder if they're pissed about it. That's really what I wonder. Is it something that they're okay with, that everybody's into something that they're into? Or are they, like, okay with it? Like, good, everybody should love Star Wars as much as I do. I'd be surprised if that was the case. All right, we're done for this week. What have we learned? Well, I think it all comes down to appreciate those who are in your life. Enjoy your life. Enjoy the experiences. Enjoy the work. Enjoy the process. Enjoy those around you. Hug them. Tell them you love them. Keep the people who mean something to you close. I think that's the most important thing, because one day, for each one of us, this, as we know it, all goes away. So appreciate it. Spread the word. Celebrate the people who are no longer here with those who also value them. That's important. And just go for it. Go for the experiences. Do the work. Find whatever it is you're passionate about and work at it while you're working your day job, because that's likely how it's going to go. And make sure you stick to it, and hopefully that will become your job down the line. Because remember, every single one of these guys worked. And now they have a body of work that is their legacy that we will celebrate them for. And that all came from them ultimately doing the work. And you know what? Maybe one day this is going to be played when I'm gone. Hell, that'd be kind of nice. When Chris Abalo's gone, somebody will play back this bit saying, oh, he recorded this in 2016 when he was talking about leaving a legacy and whatever, and working at what you want to work in and making your life's work happen, blah, 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 all that other stuff. That's kind of cool that this show will be part of my legacy. This smaller independent show that it is now will eventually be something else. And hopefully this will be played back as you fondly remember me and celebrate me. But I'm not saying this to pat myself on the back. I'm saying, go for it. Tell those you love that you love them, and enjoy life. Enjoy yourselves. Enjoy the experiences. Enjoy the work. Enjoy it all. The good, the bad, and the ugly, because we only get one ride on the merry-go-round. And anyway, that's it. Please follow the show at Cape Pod on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr, and subscribe to the show on iTunes or through various Android apps. Those links are at chrisabala.com. We're going to go out the way we came in with Def Leppard's cover of Rebel Rebel by David Bowie. And please visit chrisabala.com for all sorts of good stuff. My favorite things from 2015. That blog is going to be coming up, and it will be peppered with things that were also disappointments for me in 2015, for books and films and concerts and music and all sorts of stuff. So look out for that. That will be available next week along with another show. So our time is up. But until next time, this is Chris Abalo, and this was yet another experiment.